anybody wants to write a postcard before you leave. And now Simeon Barry. Simeon Barry was born in Guilford, Connecticut, and was educated at the New College of Florida and Eckerd College. He received an MFA in poetry from Indiana University at Bloomington, and has been an associate editor for Plowshares and won a Massachusetts Cultural Council Individual Artist Grant and a Career Chapter Award from the National Society of Arts and Letters. His work has appeared in Crazy Horse, Agni, Colorado Review, Blackbird, Diagram, the Iowa Review, American Letters and Commentary, and many other journals. His first book, Ampersand Revisited, won the 2013 National Poetry Series, and his second book, Monograph, won the 2014 National Poetry Series. Moreover, Simeon is an incredibly generous and humble person who is willing to share his experiences in life and in writing. And it's great to have such a generous person here today. Thank you.
Thank you for that wonderful introduction, Amanda, and thank you to the Writers Center for having me. This is a fine institution, and it makes me happy for the future of literature, which is in a dire state given our rapidly vanishing NEA and NEH. I thought I'd read from my first two books. Neither of the books have individual poem titles, so I won't be able to give you any, like, you know, countdown of, like, three poems left, two poems left. I release you. Go into the night. I find this funny. For someone who fetishizes line breaks, they actually, most of it is prose blocks and contain the minimum amount of line breaks required to sustain human life. And finally, before I begin, I always feel compelled at poetry readings to inform the audience that it's actually not statutorily forbidden to laugh. If you sense some mordant humor in these poems, that's probably because it was intentional. So for my first book, I'm going to read from is Ampersand Revisited. Every morning of senior year, your roommate ensures you awaken to the sound of Elvis grimacing over his guitar strings on the tape deck. He was sexy and contrite and filled his pockets with kibble for hellhounds. You get up from your bed as if from river mud and straighten your psychic string tie. Though you will be largely ignored, you are a cult with fact behind the screeched courses of your prep school uniform. You can explain anything, except why you stumble back to your dorm bloodied from running through the woods. Your roommate sighs and unscrews his computer for the gray ganglion of pot hidden behind the circuit board. For once, you spark up that treble clef of smoke and lie back on the ridiculous aqua comforter your mother gave you, holding your breath forever with runner's lungs. It is the only talent he envies you for. In due course, you go off in ill-fitting tweed to classes where your nervousness makes you seem thoughtful. So, when you think about it, A Tale of Two Cities is really about being impotent. All right, maybe not totally. Long silences invariably follow, which you endure by staring out the window at a lawn so deeply green it looks botanically assassinated. Then the discussion resumes, as if you had simply never spoken. Insomnia means you spend a lot of time watching the wind on the moonlit soccer field make silvery math of the grass. You sense that someone, a person with no face, is waiting off stage, ready to replace you. This impersonal menace needs to be explained again to the benign X-ray of Cassiopeia, toward which your father says everything anyone has ever felt or spoken is traveling still, broadcast like the sadness of a vaudeville joke on the radio. Every night, just before you fall asleep, other voices start talking amongst themselves in the monochrome waters at the deep end of your brain. You try not to think about this too much, and there is nothing to be done that wouldn't involve medication. Your thesis argues that the astral plane is a theme park for religious hallucinations, and your advisor lets you know the other faculty think you're somewhat non-traditional for a scholarship kid, meaning surprisingly weird. None of the teachers appear to understand your paper at all, and the white Rastafarian student says, they just don't get that you're kind of a mystic. he's wrong, of course, but it's sweet of him to say. So you take him up on his offer of recreational cough syrup before class. Through the liquefied air, you hear the classics teacher ask why Odysseus is so pissed, and you diagnose it as too many muscles. Also, there's that other thing. He's amused. Oh, just what would that be? You shrug languidly. The dead. They just don't fucking listen. You are convinced that your classmates are secretly interesting and funny when you're not around. You never imagined that they might be profoundly disappointed by their inner lives. Then Jessica asks you to the prom. She's cute, and you feel merely penciled into the margins of the universe. You share the neon silence of what she terms the ambivalent limo, but this reticence is nowhere in evidence afterwards in the kitchen of the convention hall. She cries on your shoulder and grimly finishes the last of the smuggled osti. Her mascara runs to tribal marks as she tells you her last boyfriend locked himself in the bathroom for 3 hours after their first time. I wanted to be on top, she says, and I got, overly excited. Instead, you mimic the dorm mother telling the two field hockey captains, break it up, folks, when she caught them in bed, stripped down to their moderately festive skirts. She laughs. In other hotels throughout the city, some girls are crawling under beds to get away from their dates. Some are doing shots off Ouija boards. Some are trying to explain away the lightly stunned look of the very drunk. In here, you have done a good thing. You even suspect that you've gotten away with it. Your advisor calls you out of lunch to his office to tell you gently that your uncle and his flight instructor ran out of gas and crashed their Piper Cub in an empty field. Some minutes pass. You thank him for telling you, then take your glassy composure out into the red voltage of oak leaves drifting onto the streets. You are 17, and now he is only a word burning in dry grass. You say calmly to no one, this is probably going to hurt a lot later. But it doesn't, and you don't know why. You become quite alert and write very small things in your diary with a great deal of precision. The lacrosse star chases steroids with LSD and storms into your room to talk about geometry in an angry and unspecific way. During parents' weekend, he trashes his room when the acid unlocks a latent psychosis, which is loud but not unexpected. 12 weeks pass, and your father sends you a desperately casual letter with blanks for you to fill in. Are classes going well? Enter correct address here. Other things you would like to tell me about. When you finally answer his calls, he asks what you've been doing, and you reply, thinking about the Sumerians, because you don't want to seem lazy. These are latter days. You regard the writ of frost on the window pane as a blueprint for something yet to come, something severe and intricate. Every few weeks, the drowned pilot from the bay walks up the stairs dripping wet, but you go back to your bed over the furnace before he reaches the top. It's important to try to be practical about these things. See the apparition, then go back to sleep. Your sheets are stark parchment, lit by a burning telegram that gives off the incense of human hair. It's still 1985, and your mother is downstairs having sex with Hector and his cut-rate cocaine. When you tell this to your father, you add, forsooth? Not everything about the medieval mind is witty, but you seem to think that it makes you approachable. It does not. In your father's filing cabinet, a short letter claims your IQ is exclamation point, percentage, exclamation point, and you wish you never found it. It does not make the fifth grade any easier, and even though it seems like the last detail, you know there are more to come. Across the room, your younger brother relaxes into the hoarse declaratives from his relentless hardcore records. The lead singers are averse to consonants, and seem to feel that everything, mind, body, spirit, the world, has failed them. He lowers his fall of blonde hair, taking his face away elaborately. You love him because he suffers without excuse, unlike your older brother, who must ostentatiously starve himself with organic vegetables. Duncan seems mauled by his spirit animals and just barely manages to be irritably serene. He looks up from his radishes and kale and says that you must leave the house. He is going to channel the bear now, and it is very loud. This seems neither new age nor polite, but you have no choice. The low afternoon light solders the sliding glass door into a slab of gold circuitry, and you step out cautiously into the phasic shapes of the fallen snow. There are those who will hate you because you like to live in explanation, that ideal sinking city, its placid canals blind with beautiful data. Consequently, you try to be so unruffled that people either find you boring or exotic. This has mixed results. Your biology teacher alludes to aliens, pyramids, and auras, but seems to have a sense of humor. So when he hands you a sharp glyph of crystals, you blurt out, "My father used to be a clairvoyant healer. That's what he did in Europe." You look up. Oh, was that out loud? It was. You can see it on your teacher's face as she thinks hard, trying to work around the black orchid growing more specific and lovely in his occipital lobe. There is no end point, no perfect, luminous principle. Your loved ones begin to curate their own absences. The high-pressure system of acne moving across your face helps. You're grateful for the mild, pointillist flavor of the pain. It brings you back to yourself. Your younger brother grimly reads anarchists who held grenades and adjectives in equal esteem. Then he sorts bundles of pot furled into green dynamite. "I love you, but I gotta blow this up. Can you take it outside?" You take it all outside. You stare into the plutonium maze under the hood of your older brother's Ford. It's depressing. He fusses over it like a siege engine. Yuki paid for the transmission. It's no good. What a mistake that was to sleep with her. He is terribly attended. He blunders through rounds of spiritual retreats, confronting people until he is asked to leave. He uses women, then drops them, blaming archetypes, when they realize he will never be capable of holding down a regular job. The metaphors of alchemy, the dross and the gold, the ordinary and the sublime, eat him alive. The vaporish tapes and New Age pamphlets do not help. Eventually, everything you recognize as his, all the words that are him, spiral continuously out of his hoard, out of his head, like Coriolis horns. You will want to speak up, to fix his grammar, but in the end, it's just him and the bull on the tracks, the black horns meeting his blue ones as he leaps off onto the off the train station edge. So for a change of pace, I'm going to close from reading from Monograph, which is just a bunch of prose blocks. A few years ago, I got interested in the genre of the divorce book. Anne Carson's The Beauty of the Husband, James Galvin's X, Mary Jo Bang's Louise in Love, and I thought I'd try my hand at it. You'll notice that the people are identified only by initials, which is both for legal and entertainment reasons. Monograph. Thought back to that first October after moving to the city, both of us temping, broke, and in debt. Barely able to afford the rent on a basement efficiency next to the elevator. Our sole extravagance, a bonsai tree stiffening on the window. Fairly certain we were doomed as a couple. Repeating this to myself every night as I walked home in darkness through the close suburban streets, the smell of the sea infiltrating the fog, utterly ecstatic with rage. When my grandfather tried to tell my dad obliquely that my mother was mentally ill, he had to take him out on the water in a rowboat to do it. There they were safe, or at least equally in danger. He, like other New England fishermen, could not swim. These are the people I come from. R, says C, has been dredging up a bunch of sexual trauma. This is the second girl he's dated who was raped in the past. Last night, he came home stoned. C was enraged, and when he turned his back on her, she punched him. He just said, "I can't believe you did that," then walked away. She rushed after him, shouting, "Wait, don't you want to know why I hit you?" When my dad was traveling and teaching healing in Europe, he woke in his hotel one morning and discovered that his passport was missing. The room was full of spirit guides, arguing about where he should go next. As soon as he yelled at them, they vanished, and the passport instantly appeared right in front of him on the nightstand. These kinds of ambiguous difficulties are not, as they say, in the literature, but they're what make this real for me. If I took anything from my father's universe, it's that everyone has an agenda, even when they don't have a body. N told me she trained herself to masturbate with highlighters. First one, then two, then three. It was her reward for homework. "I cannot imagine," she thought, "I would be able to resist lingering over this metaphor. How French to make scholarship seem sexy. How American to make the emphasis literal." When I was born, I weighed 8 pounds. 12 months later, I was back down to my birth weight and dying. During this year, my mother wore jeans every day, the same pair of jeans. Clearly, she did not want to be recognized as anything other than a depressed person. There are worse uniforms, I suppose. Compared notes with D. He has sex about 3 times a month, while I have sex only twice a month. He was cheerful. "Well, it sounds like your marriage is in a lot worse shape than mine." He's thinking of bugging his wife's computer because he suspects she is cheating. She calls him drunk at 3 a.m. to ask him to come and pick her up from his friend's house. He wishes, with a great deal of fervency, that he could confirm his suspicion that she was sexually abused as a child. It's all very East German. The night Virginia Woolf finally slept over, her lover, Vita Sackville-West, memorialized the event in her diary by simply writing 3 exclamation points. I myself would want 4, which demonstrates that the first thing one wants to do with a great metaphor is to wreck it. The first time I come home with N, her father and sister pick us up at night in the airport in a blizzard. They have already opened a case of beer, and they all drink steadily during the harrowing drive back through the mountains. I say nothing. I just think to myself, okay, so that's how it is. Later, I realize that this is not how it usually is. They were making a point. Return for the second half of Christmas with N's family. Overhear her father gloating to a friend on the phone about his lack of reaction when opening their presents. You should have seen their faces. So crestfallen. N says he is difficult to shop for. I stare into my pallid eggnog as the plastic cup flexes in my hand. Went out last night with M in a lavender tie and a purple shirt. Felt like a sexual racketeer. Raymond Chandler would have approved. M says he is fighting every night with R, who is triumphantly agoraphobic. They both scream and cry and threaten to flee the apartment. Then they have sex. At first, I was frightened, then jealous, then frightened again. N confesses to me that she watched G.I. Joe as a kid and that she wanted to be Scarlet. I myself loved the mute, scarred Snake Eyes. I am dumbfounded. Even as a 10-year-old, I found the show unbelievably hokey. No one ever got killed, and their M16s fired dotted lines of lasers, despite the fact that they were clearly wearing belts of ammunition. At first, I marvel over the irony. I'm a pacifist who's never been in a fight. She's a reformed radical lesbian. Yet we like the same campy military cartoon. Then I get sad. This is what you fall in love over. Dreamed that a lot of people had been killed and buried in the sand. Realized that this was Bloody Cove of my childhood, where a bunch of Native Americans were massacred, and where I had daily lessons on the tennis courts every summer. According to my grandfather, this was what a well-bred young man did, along with sailing and ignoring the 20th century. Not terribly surprising that I tend to think of masculinity itself as a type of minor catastrophe. My dad shows me his journal entry from the year before I was born. The one where I came to him in a dream and said that I would be a writer, that I would be delivered 2 weeks early, that I would be a C-section, and that there would be no blood. All of which came true, even the blood. The doctor was amazed. I've kept this in so you know I can't be trusted, right? My mother tries to convince me not to leave N by enlisting the Jehovah's Witnesses with whom she has been flirting. They understand about mysteries, she says, about what draws people together. Well, what I understand, I say, is that they have incorrectly predicted the end of the world 16 times. She gets angry. So you're going to be just like your father, who didn't think we should be a family? Is that what you want? I barely refrain from pointing out that even though he was the one who filed, she chose to get divorced. He wasn't going to leave her. That is, until he discovered that the only thing that was more exciting for her than secretly having sex with a drug dealer who didn't speak any English was refusing to stop when she was caught. It couldn't just be a mistake. It had to be a story. Galen held that in order for a woman to conceive, she must achieve orgasm. Using this logic, if you got pregnant from a rape, you must have enjoyed it and therefore consented in the first place, making it not a rape. This Roman belief is what gave rise to a flurry of Victorian property law. They were worried about social climbing, that women would be forced to marry their lower-class rapists and give them their dowries. This is why they were not allowed to own anything. Mind you, the Victorians also tried to claim that the rampant prostitution in the streets was just an epidemic of nymphomania. The poor dears. I am supposed to write an invocation for a friend of N's who's getting married. We fight over my draft for hours. It is not, she says, about them, about love. I talk about the Curies distilling 7 tons of pitch blend in order to get a tenth of a gram of radium, how they lived in poverty in an unheated shack and had to take turns stirring the slag with a heavy iron bar for hours. But they were happy together. I leave out the part where Marie dies from having blithely carried radioactive vials around in her coat pocket. She kept test tubes of the stuff in her desk and loved the pretty blue-green light it gave off in the dark. N and I are discussing the perfected female body and whether or not pleasure is inversely proportionate to form. I think of the early Islamic scholars and mystics who invented the idea of the auri, namely a woman who is hairless, except for the eyebrows and head, who does not menstruate, urinate, or defecate, and is transparent right down to the marrow of her bones, like red wine in a white glass. N tries to end the discussion by declaring, "I just want to be a Barbie that's capable of orgasm." I laugh, then realize I'm suddenly very angry, though I'm not sure on whose behalf. S refuses the label of a golden lesbian. Not only has she touched men, she quite enjoyed having sex with them. My poetry professor used to say that there was no such thing as a synonym. I still believe in them, but not the way I used to. I'm sad, so I go alone to the candlelight mass at Christmas. My favorite part is the end, when the sexton brings down the light, and I'm alone with the feeling of breathing in a dark building with hundreds of people. I think of the secret gospel of Mark, the one with the verses where Lazarus falls in love with Jesus after being raised. He spends the night alone with him, dressed only in a linen cloth, so that Jesus can teach him the mystery of God's domain. I reach out for N's absent hand in the pitch black. We're outside on the lawn at a neighbor's extravagant birthday party with N's family. Her father's irritated that he's not the center of attention, so there's more than the usual amount of maintenance drinking. Anne wonders aloud where they're hiding the good stuff. Her father snorts. Don't be a fucking moron. There is no good stuff. Anne's eyes shine with tears, and she looks away, pretending to stare at the derelict ice sculpture melting into the shrimp. I realize that my fists are rising from my sides, and I stop them. My dad discloses that he actually briefly succeeded in dragging my mother to couples counseling. After their time was up, the therapist announced with peculiar intensity, "The men's bathroom is down the hall to the right." As my dad was returning, the therapist slipped out and intercepted him in the corridor. "I shouldn't be doing this," he said. "It's not even professional. But that woman in there just wants a house and money, and she wants you to take care of everything." He paused meaningfully. They looked at each other. "Generally, men bore me, but I have to admire this moment. We may not be able to approximate an honest emotion, but damned if we can't float an implication." Z helps me look past the long conversation, wherein I will attempt to explain to N that experiencing a crippling orgasm of fury when it comes time to apologize is fatal, romantically speaking. "All you have to do," he says, "is utter these things calmly, look at her out of slitted eyes, and then vanish, like a ninja." I am not comforted. Where will I go? Am I going to be one of those divorced people with an empty loft? Z shakes his head. "Don't be silly. Ninjas don't need furniture." N reveals in couples therapy that she went off birth control 3 months ago, as if she had actually told me that she was no longer taking her pills. She says it with such a lack of emphasis that it takes me a moment. Then the room becomes bright and horribly detailed. Go out with X to the redwoods. They're so massive, I have no trouble imagining why druids worship trees. One has fallen beside the path, and we climb onto the trunk. X starts taking pictures. I hunker down in the shafts of mathematical light coming through the trees and read the graffiti. Z plus DL, always. I don't know why I love the omissions. They make me want to go back, to fix the asterisks other people have carved over them. However brief it is, this foreshortened equation is still, like everything else in the universe, made up of names. I start crying. Not in a thoughtful or becoming way, in an ugly way, in a way that only has one purpose. X takes shot after shot of me. I don't look up. Before I knelt down, I thought slyly that this might make a nice author photograph. Now it will be something other. After swimming, E and I drive through the calm oaks on either side of the back road. We stop at a gourmet grocery set randomly beside a field, buy pomegranates and dark chocolate, and sit down at the edge of the parking lot. Watch the effortless light on the tall grass, the sun going down. E talks about the Masons, theoretical particles, her new love, what they do and don't have to do with each other. I say nothing, which makes me suspect that I am happy. N would never let me kiss or lick the small seraph on the side of her breast where they removed the mass. It was neither benign nor malignant, simply anomalous. I liked it because it made me think of the Japanese art of kintsugi. When a work of ceramic broke, they would inlay the cracks with gold and find it more beautiful afterward, because it existed in time now and had a history. Thanks so much.